It could have been that the gas dripped down to the handles of some of those torches, and when they lit them, why, those holding them panicked and threw them any which way just to get rid of them. Whatever, that black November night was suddenly blazing with torches. Some was holding them up and waving them around, little flaming pieces of burlap falling off in the tops of them. Some of them were laughing, but like I say, some of the others up and threw them through the back windows into what was our kitchen. The place was burning merry hell in a minute and a half. The men outside, they were all wearing their peaky white hoods by then. Some of them were chanting, "Come out, niggers, come out, niggers, come out, niggers." Maybe some of them were chanting to scare us, but I like to believe most of them were trying to warn us, same way as I like to believe that maybe those torches going into the kitchen the way they did was an accident. Either way, it didn't much matter. The band was playing louder than a factory whistle. Everybody was whooping it up and having a good time. Nobody inside knew anything was wrong until Jerry McCrew, who was playing assistant cook that night, opened the door to the kitchen and damn near got blowtorched. Flame shot out 10 feet and burned his mess jacket right off, burned most of his hair off as well. I was sitting about halfway down the east wall with Trev Dawson and Dick Halloran when it happened, and at first I had an idea the gas stove had exploded. I'd no more than got on my feet when I was knocked down by people headed for the door. About 2 dozen of them went marching right up my back, and I guess that was the only time during the whole thing that I really felt scared. I could hear people screaming and telling each other they had to get out. The place was on fire. But every time I tried to get up, someone footed me right back down again. Someone landed his big shoe square in the back of my head, and I saw stars. My nose mashed on that oiled floor, and I snuffled up dirt and began to cough and sneeze at the same time. Someone else stepped on the small of my back. I felt a lady's high heel slam down between the cheeks of my butt, and son, I never want another half-ass enema like that one. If the seat of my khakis had ripped, I believe I'd be bleeding down there to this day. It sounds funny now, but I damn near died in that stampede. I was whopped, whapped, stomped, walked on, and kicked in so many places I couldn't walk tall the next day. I was screaming, and none of those people topside heard me or paid any mind. It was Trev saved me. I seen this big brown hand in front of me, and I grabbed it like a drowning man grabs a life preserver. I grabbed, and he hauled, and up I came. Someone's foot got me in the side of my neck right here.
He massaged that area where the jaw turns up toward the ear, and I nodded.
And it hurt so bad that I guess I blacked out for a minute. But I never let go of Trev's hand, and he never let go of mine. I got to my feet finally, just as the wall we'd put up between the kitchen and the hall fell over. It made a noise like floop, the noise a puddle of gasoline makes when you light it. I saw it go over in a big bundle of sparks, and I saw the people running to get out of its way as it fell. Some of them made it, some didn't. One of our fellas, I think it might have been Hort Sartoris, was buried under it, and for just 1 second, I seen his hand underneath all those blazing coals, opening and closing. There was a white girl, surely no more than 20, and the back of her dress went up. She was with a college boy, and I heard her screaming at him, begging him to help her. He took just about 2 swipes at it, and then ran away with the others. She stood there screaming as her dress went up on her. It was like hell out where the kitchen had been. The flames were so bright you couldn't look at them. The heat was baking hot, Mikey, roasting hot. You could feel your skin going shiny. You could feel the hairs in your nose getting crispy. "We gotta break out of here," Trev yells and starts to drag me along the wall. "Come on." Then Dick Halloran catches hold of him. He couldn't have been no more than 19, and his eyes were as big as billiard balls. But he kept his head better than we did. He saved our lives. "Not that way," he yells. "This way." And he pointed back toward the bandstand, toward the fire, you know. "You're crazy," Trevor screamed back. He had a big, bull voice, but you could barely hear him over the thunder of the fire and the screaming people. "Die if you want to, but me and Willie are getting out." He still had me by the hand, and he started to haul me toward the door again, although there were so many people around it by then you couldn't see it at all. I would have gone with him. I was so shell-shocked I didn't know what end was up. All I knew was that I didn't want to be baked like a human turkey. Dick grabbed Trev by the hair of the head just as hard as he could, and when Trev turned back, Dick slapped his face. I remember seeing Trev's head bounce off the wall and thinking Dick had gone crazy. Then he was hollering in Trev's face. You go that way and you gon' die. They jammed up against that door, nigger. You don't know that, Trev screamed back at him. And then there was this loud bang, like a firecracker. Only what it was the heat-exploding Marty Devereaux's bass drum. The fire was running along the beams overhead and the oil on the floor was catching. I know it, Dick screams back. I know it. He grabbed my other hand, and for a minute there I felt like the rope in a tug-of-war game. Then Trev took a good look at the door and went Dick's way. Dick got us down to a window and grabbed a chair to bust it out. But before he could swing it, the heat blew it out for him. Then he grabbed Trev Dawson by the back of his pants and hauled him up. Climb, he shouts. Climb, motherfucker. And Trev went, head up and tail over the dashboard. He boosted me next, and I went up. I grabbed the sides of the window and hauled. I had a good crop of blisters all over my palms the next day. That wood was already smoking. I come out head first, and if Trev hadn't grabbed me, I might have broke my neck. We turned back around, and it was like something from the worst nightmare you ever had, Mikey. That window was just a yellow blazing square of light. Flames was shooting up through that tin roof in a dozen places. We could hear people screaming inside. I saw two brown hands waving around in front of the fire, Dick's hands. Trev Dawson made me a step with his own hands, and I reached through that window and grabbed Dick. When I took his weight, my gut went against the side of the building, and it was like having your belly against a stove that's just starting to get real good and hot. Dick's face came up, and for a few seconds I didn't think we was going to be able to get him. He'd taken a right smart of smoke, and he was close to passing out. His lips had cracked open, the back of his shirt was smoldering. And then I damn near let go because I could smell the people burning inside. I've heard people say that smell is like barbecuing pork ribs, but it ain't like that. It's more like what happens sometimes after they geld horses. They build a big fire and throw all that shit into it, and when the fire gets hot enough, you can hear them hoss balls popping like chestnuts, and that's what people smell like when they start to cook right inside their clothes. I could smell that, and I knew I couldn't take it for long, so I gave one more great big yank, and out came Dick. He lost one of his shoes. I tumbled off Trev's hands and went down. Dick come down on top of me, and I'm here to tell you that nigger's head was hard. I lost most of my breath and just laid there in the dirt for a few seconds, rolling around and holding my belly guts. Presently, I was able to get to my knees, then to my feet, and I seen these shapes running off toward the green belt. At first, I thought they were ghosts, and then I seen shoes. By then, it was so bright around the black spot, it was like daylight. I seen shoes and understood it was men wearing sheets. One of them had fallen a little bit behind the others, and I saw... He trailed off, licking his lips. What did you see, Daddy? I asked. Never you mind, he said. Give me my water, Mikey.
I did. He drank most of it and then got coughing. A passing nurse looked in and said, Do you need anything, Mr. Hanlon?
New set of testins, my dad said. You got any handy, Rhoda?
She smiled a nervous, doubtful smile and passed on. My dad handed the glass to me and I put it back on his table.
It's longer telling than it is remembering, he said. You go and fill that glass up for me before you leave?
Sure, Daddy.
This story go and give you nightmares, Mikey?
I opened my mouth to lie, and then thought better of it. And I think now that if I had lied, he would have stopped right there. He was far gone by then, but maybe not that far gone.
I guess so, I said. That's not such a bad thing, he said to me. In nightmares, we can think the worst. That's what they're there for, I guess.
He reached out his hand, and I took it, and we held hands while he finished.
I looked around just in time to see Trev and Dick going around the front of the building, and I chased after them, still trying to catch my wind. There was maybe 40 or 50 people out there, some of them crying, some of them puking, some of them screaming, some of them doing all three things at once, it seemed like. Others were laying on the grass, fainted dead away with the smoke. The door was shut, and we heard people screaming on the other side, screaming to let them out, out for the love of Jesus. They were burning up. It was the only door, except for the one that went through the kitchen to where the garbage cans and things were, you see. To go in, you pushed the door open. To go out, you had to pull it. Some people had gotten out, and then they started to jam up at that door and push. The door got slammed shut. The ones in the back kept pushing forward to get away from the fire, and everybody got jammed up. The ones right up front were squashed. Wasn't no way they could get that door open against the weight of all those behind. So there they were, trapped, and the fire raged. It was Trev Dawson that made it so it was only 80 or so that died instead of 100 or maybe 200, and what he got for his pains wasn't a medal, but 2 years in the Rye Stockade. See, right about then, this big old cargo truck pulled up, and who should be behind the wheel but my old friend Sergeant Wilson, the fella who owned all the holes there on the base. He gets out and starts shouting orders that didn't make much sense and which people couldn't hear anyway. Trev grabbed my arm and we went over to him. I lost all track of Dick Halloran by then and didn't even see him until the next day. "Sergeant, I have to use your truck," Trev yells in his face. "Get out of my way, nigger," Wilson says and pushes him down. Then he starts yelling all that confused shit again. Wasn't nobody paying any attention to him, and he didn't go on for long anyway because Trevor Dawson popped up like a jack-in-the-box and decked him. Trev could hit damned hard, and almost any other man would have stayed down, but that cracker had a hard head. He got up, blood pouring out of his mouth and nose, and he said, "I'm going to kill you for that." Well, Trev hit him in the belly just as hard as he could. And when he doubled over, I put my hands together and pounded the back of his neck just as hard as I could. It was a cowardly thing to do, hitting a man from behind like that. But desperate times call for desperate measures. And I would be lying, Mikey, if I didn't tell you that hitting that poor-mouthed son of a bitch didn't give me a bit of pleasure. Down he went, just like a steer hit with a pole axe. Trev run to the truck, fired it up, and drove it around so it was facing the front of the black spot, but to the left of the door. He throwed it into first, popped the clutch on that cocksucker, and here he come. "Look out there," I shouted at the crowd of people standing around. "Where that truck?" They scattered like quail, and for a wonder, Trev didn't hit none of them. He hit the side of the building going maybe 30, and cracked his face a good one on the steering wheel of the truck. I seen the blood fly from his nose when he shook his head to clear it. He punched out reverse, backed up 50 yards, and come down on her again. Wham! The black spot wasn't nothing but corrugated tin, and that second hit did her. The whole side of that oven fell in, and the flames come roaring out. How anything could have still been alive in there, I don't know, but there was. People are a lot tougher than you'd believe, Mikey. And if you don't believe it, just take a look at me, sliding off the skin of the world by my fingernails. That place was like a smelting furnace. It was a hell of flames and smoke, but people came running out in a regular torrent. There were so many that Trev didn't even dare back the truck up again for fear he would run over some of them. So he got out and ran back to me, leaving it where it was. We stood there, watching it end. It hadn't been 5 minutes all told, but it felt like forever. The last dozen or so that made it out were on fire. People grabbed him and started to roll him around on the ground, trying to put him out. Looking in, we could see other people trying to come, and we knew they wasn't never going to make it. Trev grabbed my hand, and I grabbed him back twice as hard. We stood there holding hands just like you and me are doing now, Mikey. Him with his nose broken, blood running down his face, and his eyes puffing shut, and we watched them people. They were the real ghosts we saw that night. Nothing but shimmers shaped like men and women in that fire, walking toward the opening Trev had bashed with Sergeant Wilson's truck. Some of them had their arms held out, like they expected someone to save them. The others just walked, but they didn't seem to get nowhere. Their clothes were blazing, their faces were running, and one after another they just toppled over and you didn't see them no more. The last one was a woman. Her dress had burned off her, and there she was in her slip. She was burning like a candle. She seemed to look right at me at the end, and I seen her eyelids was on fire. When she fell down, it was over. The whole place went up in a pillar of fire. By the time the base fire trucks and two more from the Main Street fire station got there, it was already burning itself out. That was the fire at the black spot, Mikey. He drank the last of his water and handed me the glass to fill at the drinking fountain in the hall. "Gon' piss the bed tonight, I guess, Mikey." I kissed his cheek and then went out into the hall to fill his glass. When I returned, he was drifting away again, his eyes glassy and contemplative. When I put the glass on the night table, he mumbled a thank you I could barely understand. I looked at the west clocks on his table and saw it was almost 8.
Time for me to go home. I leaned over to kiss him goodbye and instead heard myself whisper, "What did you see?" His eyes, which were now slipping shut, barely turned toward the sound of my voice. He might have known it was me, or he might have believed he was hearing the voice of his own thoughts.
"Huh?"
"The thing you saw," I whispered. I didn't want to hear, but I had to hear. I was both hot and cold, my eyes burning, my hands freezing, but I had to hear. As I suppose Lot's wife had to turn back and look at the destruction of Sodom.
"'Twas a bird," he said, "right over the last of those running men. A hawk, maybe, what they call a kestrel. But it was big. Never told no one. Would have been locked up. That bird was maybe 60 feet from wingtip to wingtip. It was the size of a Japanese Zero. But I seen its eyes, and I think it seen me."
His head slipped over to the side, toward the window, where the dark was coming.
"It swooped down and grabbed that last man up. Got him right by the sheet, it did. And I heard that bird's wings. The sound was like fire, and it hovered. And I thought, birds can't hover. But this one could because...
He fell silent.
"Why, Daddy?"
I whispered.
"Why could it hover?" "It didn't hover," he said.
I sat there in silence, thinking he had gone to sleep for sure this time. I had never been so afraid in my life, because 4 years before, I had seen that bird. Somehow, in some unimaginable way, I had nearly forgotten that nightmare. It was my father who brought it back.
"It didn't hover," he said. "It floated. It floated. There were big bunches of balloons tied to each wing, and it floated."
My father went to sleep. March 1st, 1985. It's come again. I know that now. I'll wait, but in my heart, I know it. I'm not sure I can stand it. As a kid, I was able to deal with it, but it's different with kids. In some fundamental way, it's different. I wrote all of that last night in a kind of frenzy, not that I could have gone home anyway. Derry has been blanketed in a thick glaze of ice, and although the sun is out this morning, nothing is moving. I wrote until long after 3 this morning, pushing the pen faster and faster, trying to get it all out. I had forgotten about seeing the giant bird when I was 11. It was my father's story that brought it back, and I never forgot it again. Not any of it. In a way, I suppose it was his final gift to me. A terrible gift, you would say, but wonderful in its way. I slept right where I was, my head in my arms, my notebook and pen on the table in front of me. I woke up this morning with a numb ass and an aching back, but feeling free somehow, purged of that old story. And then I saw that I had had company in the night as I slept. The tracks, drying to faint, muddy impressions, led from the front door of the library, which I locked, I always lock it, to the desk where I slept. There were no tracks leading away. Whatever it was, it came to me in the night, left its talisman, and then simply disappeared. Tied to my reading lamp was a single balloon. Filled with helium, it floated in a morning sun ray which slanted in through one of the high windows. On it was a picture of my face. The eyes gone, blood running down from the ragged sockets, a scream distorting the mouth on the balloon's thin and bulging rubber skin. I looked at it and I screamed. The scream echoed through the library, echoing back, vibrating from the circular iron staircase leading to the stacks. The balloon burst with a bang. Part 3. Grown-ups. The descent, made up of despairs and without accomplishment, realizes a new awakening, which is a reversal of despair. For what we cannot accomplish, what is denied to love, what we have lost in the anticipation, a descent follows, endless and indestructible. William Carlos Williams, Patterson. Don't it make you want to go home now? Don't it make you want to go home? Oh, God's children get weary when they roam. Don't it make you want to go home? Don't it make you want to go home? Joe South. Chapter 10. The Reunion. 1. Bill Dendro gets a cab. The telephone was ringing, bringing him up and out of a sleep too deep for dreams. He groped for it without opening his eyes, without coming more than halfway awake. If it had stopped ringing just then, he would have slipped back down into sleep without a hitch. He would have done it as simply and easily as he had once slipped down the snow-covered hills in McCarran Park on his flexible flyer. You ran with the sled, threw yourself onto it, and down you went, seemingly at the speed of sound. You couldn't do that as a grown-up. It racked the hell out of your balls. His fingers walked over the telephone's dial, slipped off, climbed it again. He had a dim premonition that it would be Mike Hanlon. Mike Hanlon calling from Derry, telling him he had to come back, telling him he had to remember, telling him they had made a promise. Stan Uris had cut their palms with a sliver of Coke bottle and they had made a promise. Except all of that had already happened. He had gotten in late yesterday afternoon, just before 6 p.m., actually. He supposed that, if he had been the last call on Mike's list, all of them must have gotten in at varying times. Some might even have spent most of the day here. He himself had seen none of them, felt no urge to see any of them. He had simply checked in, gone up to his room, ordered a meal from room service, which he found he could not eat once it was laid out before him, and then had tumbled into bed and slept dreamlessly until now. Bill cracked one eye open and fumbled for the telephone's handset. It fell off onto the table, and he groped for it, opening his other eye. He felt totally blank inside his head, totally unplugged, running on batteries. He finally managed to scoop up the phone. He got up on one elbow and put it against his ear. Hello? Bill? It was Mike Hanlon's voice. He'd had at least that much right. Last week he didn't remember Mike at all, and now a single word was enough to identify him. It was rather marvelous, but in an ominous way. Yeah, Mike. Woke you up, huh? Yeah, you did. That's okay. On the wall above the TV was an abysmal painting of lobster men in yellow slickers and rain hats pulling lobster traps. Looking at it, Bill remembered where he was. The Derry townhouse on Upper Main Street. Half a mile farther up and across the street was Basie Park, the Kissing Bridge, the canal. What time is it, Mike? 9:45. What day? The 30th. Mike sounded a little amused. Yeah, okay. I've arranged a little reunion, Mike said. He sounded diffident now. Yeah? Bill swung his legs out of bed. They all came? All but Stan Uris, Mike said. Now there was something in his voice that Bill couldn't read. Bev was the last one. She got in late last evening. Why do you say the last one, Mike? Stan might show up today. Bill, Stan's dead. What? How? Did his plane? Nothing like that, Mike said. Look, if it's all the same to you, I think it ought to wait until we get together. It would be better if I could tell all of you at the same time. It has to do with this? Yes, I think so. Mike paused briefly. I'm sure it does. Bill felt the familiar weight of dread settle around his heart again. Was it something you could get used to so quickly then? Or had it been something he had carried all along, simply unfelt and unthought of, like the inevitable fact of his own death? He reached for his cigarettes, lit one, and blew out the match with the first drag. None of them got together yesterday? No, I don't believe so. And you haven't seen any of us yet? No, just talked to you on the phone. Okay, he said. Where's the reunion? You remember where the old ironworks used to be? Past your road, sure. You're behind the times, old chum. That's Mall Road these days. We've got the third biggest shopping mall in the state out there. 48 different merchants under one roof for your shopping convenience. Sounds really American, all right. Bill? What? You all right? Yes, but his heart was beating too fast, the tip of his cigarette jittering a tiny bit. He had stuttered. Mike had heard it. There was a moment of silence, and then Mike said, Just out past the mall, there's a restaurant called Jade of the Orient. They have private rooms for parties. I arranged for one of them yesterday. We can have it the whole afternoon if we want. You think this might take that long? I just don't know. A cab will know how to get there? Sure. All right, Bill said. He wrote the name of the restaurant down on the pad by the phone. Why there? Because it's new, I guess, Mike said slowly. It seemed like, I don't know. Neutral ground, Bill suggested. Yes, I guess that's it. Food any good? I don't know, Mike said. How's your appetite? Bill chuffed out smoke and half laughed, half coughed.
It ain't so good, old pal.
Yeah, Mike said. I hear you.
Noon?
More like one, I guess. We'll let Beverly catch a few more Z's. Bill stuffed the cigarette.
She married?
Mike hesitated again. We'll catch up on everything, he said.
Just like when you go back to your old high school reunion 10 years later, huh?
Bill said.
You get to see who got fat, who got bald, who got kids.
I wish it was like that, Mike said.
Yeah, me too, Mikey. Me too.
He hung up the phone, took a long shower, and ordered a breakfast that he didn't want and which he only picked at. No, his appetite was really not much good at all. Bill dialed the big yellow cab company and asked to be picked up at 1:15, thinking that 15 minutes would be plenty of time to get him out to Pasture Road. He found himself totally unable to think of it as Mall Road, even when he actually saw the mall. But he had underestimated the lunch hour traffic flow and how much Derry had grown. In 1958, it had been a big town, not much more. There were maybe 30,000 people inside the Derry incorporated city limits, and maybe another 7,000 beyond that in the surrounding burgs. Now it had become a city, a very small city by London or New York standards, but doing just fine by Maine standards, where Portland, the state's largest, could boast barely 300,000. As the cab moved slowly down Main Street,
we're over the canal now, Bill thought. Can't see it, but it's down there, running in the dark.
And then turned up center, his first thought was predictable enough. How much had changed? But the predictable thought was accompanied by a deep dismay that he never would have expected. He remembered his childhood here as a fearful, nervous time, not only because of the summer of 58, when the seven of them had faced the terror, but because of George's death, the deep dream his parents seemed to have fallen into following that death, the constant ragging about his stutter, Bowers and Huggins and Chris constantly on the prod for them after the rock fight in the Barrens.
Bowers and Huggins and Chris, oh my, Bowers and Huggins and Chris, oh my.
And just a feeling that Derry was cold, that Derry was hard, that Derry didn't much give a shit if any of them lived or died, and certainly not if they triumphed over Pennywise the Clown. Derry folk had lived with Pennywise in all his guises for a long time. And maybe, in some mad way, they had even come to understand him. To like him, need him. Love him? Maybe. Yes, maybe that too. So why this dismay? Perhaps only because it seemed such dull change, somehow. Or perhaps because Derry seemed to have lost its essential face for him. The Bijou Theater was gone, replaced with a parking lot, by permit only, the sign over the ramp announced, violators subject to tow. The Shoe Boat and Bailey's Lunch, which had stood next to it, were also gone. They had been replaced by a branch of the Northern National Bank. A digital readout jutted from the front of the bland cinder block structure, showing the time and the temperature, the latter in both degrees Fahrenheit and degrees Celsius. The Center Street drug, lair of Mr. Keene, and the place where Bill had gotten Eddie his asthma medicine that day, was also gone. Richard's Alley had become some strange hybrid called a mini-mall. Looking inside as the cab idled at a stoplight, Bill could see a record shop, a natural food store, and a toys and games shop which was featuring a clearance sale on all Dungeons and Dragons supplies. The cab pulled forward with a jerk. Gonna take a while, the driver said. I wish all these goddamn banks would stagger their lunch hours. Pardon my French if you're a religious man.
That's all right, Bill said.
It was overcast outside, and now a few splatters of rain hit the cab's windshield. The radio muttered about an escaped mental patient from somewhere who was supposed to be very dangerous, and then began muttering about the Red Sox who weren't. Showers early, then clearing. When Barry Manilow began moaning about Mandy, who came and who gave without taking, the cabbie snapped the radio off. Bill asked,
"When did they go up?"
"What? The banks?"
"Uh-huh."
"Oh, late 60s, early 70s, most of them," the cabbie said. He was a big man with a thick neck. He wore a red and black checked hunter's jacket. A fluorescent orange cap was jammed down squarely on his head. It was smudged with engine oil.
"They got this urban renewal money. Revenue sharing, they call it. So how they shared it was ripped down everything. And the banks come in. I guess that was all that could afford to come in. Hell of a note, ain't it? Urban renewal, says they. Shit for dinner, says I. Pardon my French if you're a religious man. There was a lot of talk about how they was going to revitalize the downtown. Yep, they revitalized it just fine. Tore down most of the old stores and put up a lot of banks and parking lots. And you know, you still can't find a fucking slot to park your car in. Ought to string the whole city council up by their cocks. Except for that Polack woman that's on it. String her up by her tits. On second thought, it don't seem like she's got any. Flat as a fucking board. Pardon my French if you're a religious man.
I am, Bill said, grinning.
Then get out of my cab and go to fucking church, the cabbie said, and they both burst out laughing.
You lived here long? Bill asked.
My whole life. Born in Derry Home Hospital, and they'll bury my fucking remains out in Mount Hope Cemetery.
Good deal, Bill said.
Yeah, right, the cabbie said. He hawked, rolled down his window, and spat an extremely large yellow-green lunger into the rainy air. His attitude, contradictory but somehow attractive, almost piquant, was one of glum good cheer. Guy who catches that won't have to buy no fucking chewing gum for a week. Pardon my French if you're a religious man.
It hasn't all changed, Bill said. The depressing promenade of banks and parking lots was slipping behind them as they climbed Center Street. Over the hill and past the First National, they began to pick up some speed.
The Aladdin's still there.
Yeah, the cabbie conceded, but just barely. Suckers tried to tear that down, too.
For another bank? Bill asked, a part of him amused to find that another part of him stood aghast at the idea.
He couldn't believe that anyone in his right mind would want to tear down that stately pleasure dome with its glittering glass chandelier, its sweeping right and left staircases, which spiraled up to the balcony, and its mammoth curtain, which did not simply pull apart when the show started, but which instead rose in magical folds and tucks and gathers, all underlit in fabulous shades of red and blue and yellow and green, while pulleys off stage ratcheted and groaned.
Not the Aladdin.
That shocked part of him cried out. How could they ever think of tearing down the Aladdin for a bank?
Yep, a bank, the cabbie said. You're fucking a... Pardon my French if you're a religious man.
It was the First Merchants of Penobscot County had its eye on the Aladdin. Wanted to pull it down and put up what they called a complete banking mall. Got all the papers from the city council and the Aladdin was condemned. Then a bunch of folks formed a committee, folks that had lived here a long time. And they petitioned, and they marched, and they hollered, and finally they had a public city council meeting about it, and Hanlon blew those suckers out.
The cabbie sounded extremely satisfied.
Hanlon? Bill asked, startled. Mike Hanlon?
Yep, the cabbie said.
He twisted around briefly to look at Bill, revealing a round, chapped face and horn-rimmed glasses with old specks of white paint on the bows.
Librarian, black fella. You know him?
I did. Bill said, remembering how he had met Mike back in July 1958. It had been Bowers and Huggins and Chris again.
Of course, Bowers and Huggins and Chris. Oh, my.
At every turn, playing their own part, unwinning vice grips driving the seven of them together, tight, tighter, tightest.
We played together when we were kids, before I moved away.
Well, there you go, the cabbie said. It's a small fucking world. Pardon my
French if you're a religious man.
Bill finished with him.
There you go, the cabbie repeated comfortably, and they rode in silence for a while before he said,
It's changed a lot, Derry has, but yeah, a lot of it's still here. The townhouse where I picked you up, the standpipe and Memorial Park. You remember that place, mister? When we were kids, we used to think that place was haunted.
I remember it, Bill said.
Look, there's the hospital. You recognize it? They were passing the Derry Home Hospital on the right now. Behind it, the Penobscot flowed toward its meeting place with the Kenduskeag. Under the rainy spring sky, the river was dull pewter. The hospital that Bill remembered, a white wood frame building with two wings, three stories high, was still there. But now it was surrounded, dwarfed, by a whole complex of buildings, maybe a dozen in all. He could see a parking lot off to the left, and what looked like better than 500 cars parked there.
My God, that's not a hospital, that's a fucking college campus, Bill exclaimed.
The cab driver cackled. Not being a religious man, I'll pardon your French. Yeah, it's almost as big as the Eastern Maine up in Bangor now. They got radiation labs and a therapy center and 600 rooms and their own laundry and God knows what else. The old hospital's still there, but it's all administration now. Bill felt a queer doubling sensation in his mind, the sort of sensation he remembered getting the first time he watched a 3D movie. Trying to bring together two images that didn't quite jibe. You could fool your eyes and your brain into doing that trick, he remembered, but you were apt to end up with a whopper of a headache. And he could feel his own headache coming on now. New dairy, fine. But the old dairy was still here, like the wooden home hospital building. The old dairy was mostly buried under all the new construction, but your eye was somehow dragged helplessly back to look at it, to look for it. The train yard's probably gone, isn't it? Bill asked. The cabbie laughed again, delighted. For someone who moved away when he was just a kid, you've got a good memory, mister. Bill thought. You should have met me last week, my French-speaking friend. It's all still out there, but it's nothing but ruins and rusty tracks now. The freights don't even stop no more. Fellow wanted to buy the land and put up a whole roadside entertainment thing. Pitch and putt, batting cages, driving ranges, mini-golf, go-karts, little shack full of video games. I don't know what all. But there's some kind of big mix-up about who owns the land now. I guess he'll get it eventually. He's a persistent fella. But right now it's in the courts. And the canal, Bill murmured as they turned off Outer Center Street and onto Pasture Road, which, as Mike had said, was now marked with a green road sign reading Mall Road. The canal's still here. Yep, the cabbie said. That'll always be here, I guess. Now the Dairy Mall was on Bill's left, and as they rolled past it, he felt that queer doubling sensation again. When they had been kids, all of this had been a great long field full of rank grasses and gigantic nodding sunflowers, which marked the northeastern end of the Barrens. Behind it, to the west, was the old Cape low-income housing development. He could remember them exploring this field, being careful not to fall into the gaping cellar hold of the Kitchener Ironworks, which had exploded on Easter Sunday in the year 1906. The field had been full of relics, and they had unearthed them with all the solemn interest of archaeologists exploring Egyptian ruins. Bricks, dippers, chunks of iron with rusty bolts hanging from them, panes of glass, bottles full of unnameable gunk that smelled like the worst poison in the world. Something bad had happened near here, too, in the gravel pit close to the dump, but he could not yet remember it. He could only remember a name, Patrick Humboldt, and that it had something to do with the refrigerator, and something about a bird that had chased Mike Hanlon. What? He shook his head. Fragments, straws in the wind, that was all. The field was gone now, as were the remains of the ironworks. Bill remembered the great chimney of the ironworks suddenly. Faced with tile, caked black with soot for the final 10 feet of its length, it had lain in the high grass like a gigantic pipe. They had scrambled up somehow and had walked along it, arms held out like tight wire walkers, laughing. He shook his head, as if to dismiss the mirage of the mall, an ugly collection of buildings with signs that said Sears and J.C. Penney and Woolworths and CVS and York Steakhouse and Walden Books and dozens of others. Roads wove in and out of parking lots. The mall did not go away, because it was no mirage. The Kitchener Ironworks was gone, and the field that had grown up around its ruins was likewise gone. The mall was the reality, not the memories. But somehow he didn't believe that. Here you go, mister, the cabbie said. He pulled into the parking lot of a building that looked like a large plastic pagoda. A little late, but better late than never, am I right? Indeed you are, Bill said. He gave the cab driver a 5. Keep the change. Good fucking deal, the cabbie exclaimed. You need someone to drive, call Big Yellow and ask for Dave. Ask for me by name. I'll just ask for the religious fella, Bill said, grinning. The one who's got his plot all picked out in Mount Hope. You got it, Dave said, laughing. Have a good one, mister. You too, Dave. He stood in the light rain for a moment, watching the cab draw away. He realized that he had meant to ask the driver one more question and had forgotten, perhaps on purpose. He had meant to ask Dave if he liked living in Derry. Abruptly, Bill Dendro turned and walked into the Jade of the Orient. Mike Hanlon was in the lobby, sitting in a wicker chair with a huge flaring back. He got to his feet, and Bill felt deep unreality wash over him, through him. That sensation of doubling was back, but now it was much, much worse. He remembered a boy who had been about 5'3", trim and agile. Before him was a man who stood about 5'7". He was skinny. His clothes seemed to hang on him, and the lines in his face said that he was on the darker side of 40 instead of only 38 or so. Bill's shock must have shown on his face because Mike said quietly, "I know how I look." Bill flushed and said, "It's not that bad, Mike. It's just that I remember you as a kid. That's all it is." "Is it?" "You look a little tired." "I am a little tired," Mike said, "but I'll make it, I guess." He smiled then, and the smile lit his face. In it, Bill saw the boy he had known 27 years ago. As the old wood-frame home hospital had been overwhelmed with modern glass and cinder block, so had the boy that Bill had known been overwhelmed with the inevitable accessories of adulthood. There were wrinkles on his forehead, lines had grooved themselves from the corners of his mouth nearly to his chin, and his hair was graying on both sides above the ears. But as the old hospital, although overwhelmed, was still there, still visible, so was the boy Bill had known. Mike stuck out his hand and said, "Welcome back to Derry, Big Bill." Bill ignored the hand and embraced Mike. Mike hugged him back fiercely, and Bill could feel his hair stiff and kinky against his own shoulder and the side of his neck. "Whatever's wrong, Mike, we'll take care of it," Bill said. He heard the rough sound of tears in his throat and didn't care. "We beat it once, and we can beat it again." Mike pulled away from him, held him at arm's length. Although he was still smiling, there was too much sparkle in his eyes. He took out his handkerchief and wiped them. "Sure, Bill," he said. "You bet." "Would you gentlemen like to follow me?" the hostess asked. She was a smiling Oriental woman in a delicate pink kimono upon which a dragon cavorted and curled its plaited tail. Her dark hair was piled high on her head and held with ivory combs. "I know the way, Rose," Mike said.
"Very good, Mr. Hanlon." She smiled at both of them. "You are well met in friendship, I think."
"I think we are," Mike said. "This way, Bill."
He led him down a dim corridor, past the main dining room, and toward a door where a beaded curtain hung.
"The others," Bill began.
"All here now," Mike said. "All that could come."
Bill hesitated for a moment outside the door, suddenly frightened. It was not the unknown that scared him, not the supernatural. It was the simple knowledge that he was 15 inches taller than he had been in 1958 and minus most of his hair. He was suddenly uneasy, almost terrified, at the thought of seeing them all again, their children's faces almost worn away, almost buried under change as the old hospital had been buried. Banks erected inside their heads where once magic picture palaces had stood.
"We grew up," he thought. "We didn't think it would happen. Not then, not to us. But it did. And if I go in there, it will be real. We're all grown-ups now."
He looked at Mike, suddenly bewildered and timid.
"How do they look?" he heard himself asking in a faltering voice. "Mike, how do they look?"
"Come in and find out," Mike said, kindly enough,